thought I would start with this this famous quote by Theodor Dobzhansky, who was the founder of experimental population genetics. And I used this at a talk I gave to the American Physical Society. They ran a thing in Boston about biology and physics, and the person who's, I've forgotten his name, but who's a big thing in the society, he came up to me and I was warming up, making sure things work. And he said, "I hate that quote. I hate it when biologists show that quote. It means they don't believe that there's any principle or any structure to anything, and it all just happens." And so the thing I wanted to start by saying to you, as I said to him at the time, I'm actually showing this quote for exactly the opposite reason. That is, that I believe that the assembly of biological systems by evolution means that there has to be, and this is an article, it's important to point out, this is an article of religious faith rather than experimentally derived wisdom for the most part, that there have to be general principles that underlie biology, and that we will not find those principles unless we think about how evolution put biological systems together, which is sort of why we're here this week. The other thing that's very important to say is, Daniel was haranguing me as we were driving from the fabulous South Coast Inn this morning about using PowerPoint, which I partly used because the last time I came here I used overheads and people had to scan overheads in, and I thought this would be easier. And there was some discussion about whether the computer inhibits people from asking questions. So what I will ask you to do is to prove me wrong. And I think one thing that would be useful, at least for the other biologists who are going to speak here today, is if every time something was unclear, you asked a question. We might not get through this overview, but it would be a very good calibration for people about what things people in this room understand well and which things they understand poorly. And so, and actually sort of in general through this week, I would like you to work on the assumption that if there's a question that you're sitting there going like, geez, this doesn't make sense, I don't understand this, that if you don't ask the question, you will not only be depriving yourself of the answer, but probably at least three other people in the audience who have the same question. Okay, so at least my opinion, this sort of interdisciplinary thing only makes any sense if people ask questions. Okay, so this is an overview. There will be some themes to it. One is that I think you could there's lots of talk about computational biology. Computational biology in many people's minds means biologists doing computation about biologists, or better yet, computer scientists or physicists who are far better qualified to do computation. I'm just going to make very briefly at the beginning of the argument that the more interesting thing in some senses is that biological systems do computations, and that we ought to think about biology in that light and think about understanding it in that light. I will give a very brief introduction to population genetics, and I guess one question, or I could skip that depending on whether people think that's useful or not. That is, I'm not a population geneticist. I'm a geneticist / cell biologist who's become someone who's interested in evolution. And so I don't have a very deep understanding of this, but it's a sort of whip through some of the formal concepts of population genetics that would have been useful to me if someone had given me a couple of years ago. And if it's useful, we can do it. And if it's not, we can skip it. Is it useful or not? Useful. Okay. Then I'll give you a long laundry list of questions that I have about evolution, and actually the perfect thing would be if people here could just answer the questions and then they could be removed from my mind. I'll be gratified but surprised if that happens, in which case the hope will be to implant them in your mind so that you can go off and think about them and become part of the community who's worrying about these questions. And last and briefly, I will try and mention at appropriate points who the speakers are who are going to be here this week, who will be able to shed some of the light on these questions. And because I didn't write their names down on the particular slides, I may occasionally forget someone. They should not take offense if they do. It's a bad memory. Or they should pipe up and go, "Oh, that's what I'm going to talk about." Okay. So here's a long list, because Daniel hates things being introduced one by one like that. Just push the button a lot of times. This is a long list of things that cells do. This is some attempt, in a way, to describe life in words. They harvest energy. This is something that's actually very importantly forgotten by geneticists, and since physicists in this area are probably inspired a lot by geneticists, it's good to remember that that's an important aspect of maintaining far from equilibrium systems. You require energy to organize them. They self-organize. There are all sorts of situations where you go from isotropic systems to anisotropic ones. In interesting cases, that anisotropy then gives rise to polarized movement. There is a strong dependence on history. The central dogma, in a sense, is a bit of a misnomer. Not only is it true that information goes backwards from RNA to DNA, which poor Francis Crick hadn't been brilliant enough to think of, although he was pretty smart about everything else, and then RNA into protein, but which information gets decoded is tremendously dependent on the context. Having the whole human genome sequence, if I had some of someone's sperm DNA and we left it here in a test tube on the desk, would not help us very much, because you could come back in as long as the University of Santa Barbara will exist for, let us hope many thousands of years, perhaps longer, and all that would have happened to that piece of DNA is that slowly, very, very slowly, because DNA is pretty chemically stable, it would have started to hydrolyze first. You would have lost the purine basis, but the donor of the DNA would not have been recapitulated on this table. Which parts of the DNA get read out depends on which proteins are in the cell, which in turn determines which proteins are in the cell. So there's this very complicated chicken, egg, chicken, or the other way around if you prefer. Cells in the best high church fashion do a lot of calling and responding to each other, so there's lots of communication. Cells influence each other's behavior. They integrate information from different sorts of systems, which I'll talk about a little bit later. They duplicate, and the subject of this week, they evolve. So an evolution implies a bunch of things. It implies the inheritance of genetic information by and large accurately, because it relies on the assumption that your progeny's genotype will be strongly related to yours. Otherwise, evolution wouldn't work. It also relies on the fact that there are mutations, that you make copying mistakes, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to change anything over time. And it relies on selection, and the bit in parentheses there I think is quite important. The selection is on functions, and it's not always easy to figure out what function is in biology, and I think that's actually one important topic that's up for debate. Okay, so borrowing a definition from John Hockfield, computation can be described as the rule-based transformation of one set of symbols into another, and here is an example. This is one of the first things that my daughter Phoebe was taught to say. And you, being physicists, I'm sure you can figure out the code there. And all the biological activities I described on the preceding slide are computations, that is, they are rule-based transformations, one set of symbols into another. And one of the points that Hockfield has made is that evolution selects for computations that increase, or one way of thinking about evolution is what organisms are being evolved to do, is to do computations based on information they receive from their internal and external environment. And when I say environment, I will often mean both internal and external, and even in terms of external, I always mean physical and biological environment. I don't just mean temperature, pressure, salinity. But these computations are not only supposed to increase fitness in the situation in which cells find themselves now, but they should also be trying to do things that will increase fitness, and I will define in a more slightly more rigorous sense what fitness means later. They should be increasing fitness in what the environment might look like in the future. And I can give you, that sounds a bit mystical, so let me give you a very clear example. Those of you who went to bed last night did so on the assumption that the sun would get up in the morning, and your body's made that assumption too. That is, you have a circadian clock, which is why your body temperature reaches its minimum somewhere between 2 and 4 in the morning and corresponding maximum in the afternoon. And your body does all sorts of things programmed on the basis that the sun will come up, which it hasn't done yet, but reliable sources insist that it will do. And that's an example of a computation that's predicting the future. Now, I think one of the things that's quite interesting about biology is how widespread is that sort of predictive capacity. It's very easy to say, oh, well, this circadian clock's a rather special system because it's very obvious, this, you know, it is a very defined rhythm that's been going on for a long time. But it's an interesting question of how often do cells, in a sense, remember something about their experiences and use that to attempt to make predictions about what the future might look like and to get ready for that future when it gets here. I'm talking about the relatively short term. We're not talking about millennia.
A rocket which is going from Iraq to Israel, it's performing a computation, it's aiming to a certain target with certain circuits which are not doing computation in a sense defined here, for example.
Well, I would say, I would...
This cell could be something which is completely analogous and analogous.
I use this in a very, very loose sense. I mean, in this sense, perhaps everything in the world is computation and well, one of the objections is that the definition is too narrow, and the other is that it's too broad.
Cells change shape, the cytoskeleton changes, they pump out sodium. In simple cell biology, what are these computations?
Well, I would give you, an example. An easier thing to think about would be a signaling system, right? That cells, you know, E. coli, when it follows gradient, makes a computation. That is, it determines the rate of change of constant.
No, but when cells divide, yes, that's not a computation. When it constricts, I don't know how E. coli, but when normal cells divide. I mean, it just worries me terribly that you say that everything interesting is going on in the cell is a computation.
Well, it depends on how you think of it.
That's what worries me.
If evolution of any system is for computation, then okay, it's a tautology.
But then it doesn't help.
Perhaps we should be adding to the list of questions that will appear in your part three.
I guess if you think when the cell divides, the cell has to pick a time and a place for division, right?
Yes, but the actual mechanics, I know, not that the cells don't, thresholds are nice examples of computation. Would you accept that?
Yeah, so I'm not arguing there is nothing in biology aside from computation.
That's what I care about.
Okay? I'm saying a lot of it, but my guess is that almost all the things are, without going back and looking at it, a lot of the things that were on the preceding slide could be, aspects of them could be described as computation.
What is an appropriate description, right? You can describe what's happening in the computer in terms of physical laws, but that's not a very good way of writing a program, right? So the question is, when you're describe the behavior of bacteria, do you want to do it with differential equations? Do you want to reduce it to physics, or?
There's an example coming up about assembly of the spindle where it might be an interesting question to argue about whether it's just mechanism or it's partly computation or yada yada yada. Okay, I mean, it may not be the next thing that comes up, but so at least yes. Well, so there's an experiment that I've been trying to talk people in the group who work with me into doing unsuccessfully, but someone nearby has tried to do, and the results are equivocal but encouraging, which is to ask, if you take cells and you put them in some environment, you have two environments, A and B, and you take cells and you put them in A and B, populations of cells, and then you switch them to an environment C, and you wait a number of cell divisions, so that anything that was whose expression was being induced in environments A or B should decline at least with the doubling time of the cells, assuming that the once you go to the new environment, you stop the expression of that thing. And you ask, is there anything that persists longer than that in some sense? Do cells have marks of their history of where they were, which you could argue in an evolutionary sense could have been selected for, because there's a probability that you'll go back into that environment, may come back again, and it may, in a sense, be help to be ready for it. So, as I said, the experiments are very equivocal at this point, but there is at least the beginnings of science that might be encouraging in that regard. Right, and it makes an important point that that physicists often bring up, which is that biologists are sort of fetishistic about trying to expose cells to very unvarying environments. The average biologist is desperately trying to control all the experimental variables and not doing a very good job of them. And so doing experiments in fluctuating environments is not something that biologists typically do. No, it's the circadian clock is a very good example. And so there are two extreme positions. Either the circadian clock is sui generis and there's no other thing like it because there's nothing as regular as the sun going up and coming down, or this is a particularly striking example that was easy for biologists to discover because they're very familiar with the fact that the sun goes up and down. And you can make an ab initio argument, which is that as long as the cost of making predictions is less than the benefit you receive if the predictions turn out to be right, then it should have been selected for in evolution. And almost everything that we can think of in evolution that should have been selected for because you can justify it on that sort of theoretical basis, it's like Hamilton's explanation of kin selection, turns out to be there.
But a lot of it depends on the discount rate.
Yeah, absolutely. It depends on the cost. But right, the cost should be low, and the, in particular the ongoing cost of
of
having something like a circadian clock, the cost of having some.
Sorry, it's cheap.
Right, but that's what I would argue, that the cost of most of these things will be peanuts, and that's why I'm making the argument. All right,
it's just worth reminding you. 25% of all your energy is involved simply in keeping sodium out of your cell.
Depends a bit on who you are. That's probably not as true of bacteria.
No, but I'm not bacteria.
Excuse me.
Well, bacteria have.
Well, you've got more bacterial cells than you have human cells.
Yeah, but
it's
just. No, it's 25% of all your energy.
Right. Well, actually, maybe we can come back to this when we talk about the formalism of population genetics, because an important thing about population genetics is you can only select for and against things whose cost or benefit is larger than 1 over your effective population size. And the human effective population size is 10 to the 4th. Okay? So anything that is better or worse for you than 0.01% counts as being neutral. Okay, so and so as long as peanuts is 0.01%, you're fine.
Maybe that's been quite entirely true, but over a long time.
No, it's not entirely over long time periods it's true.
There's another point I want to raise, maybe relevant to this discussion. Compared to other kind of computer when we used to biology, static memory is very cheap, but dynamic memory is very expensive. If you only have finite number of genes, not to be 1,000 genes where you can hold memory that can be can change. Static memory in terms of genome or regulatory elements, that's very cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Again, from that, you say it's similar to computer engineering, but I would say it's similar to engineering for no computer.
Mm.
What's the difference between that and understanding how a car functions or a plane is stabilized? Or you have feedback loops that stabilize the plane, you have rudders that answer to that, you have the same kind of...
Well, I think
it does not necessarily imply the computation in the sense of the computer or brain loop or something. It's simply a feedback network, a feedback system.
Well, but I think that's an okay. So, I'm certainly glad to see that the computer has not inhibited discussion. I could have just said engineering, right? And and if John Doyle were here as he was 2 years ago, he would have banked you up in spades. I think it's an interesting question when we think about how everything's integrated together and put together, whether it is more like civil engineering and computer engineering, and perhaps that could be one of the things, rather than trying to reach a conclusion on now, we could discuss during the week. Because I think you can make that argument both ways. And if I go on, I'll make the argument a little bit in terms of that there is a similarity to computer engineering, and in particular the writing of computer code, in the organization of things into modules or subroutines that are to some extent separable from each other and are loosely connected together. Now, that is the way that many modern mechanical devices are designed, for example, an aircraft. It's not really the way a bridge is designed, at least to the extent that I understand.
The car, design the wheels without caring about the motor inside. You design the shifting gear also without much thinking about the... So modularity is the general way of designing anything. I'm not sure that... From my point of view, maybe the most interesting is how do you do engineering with chemical reactions or with chemical equations in the back. How do you modularity with chemistry?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I think getting
getting
overly hung up on what sort of engineer. All right, because Nama has to have her time in the fog too. So hopefully, this is less controversial than anything that's been said so far. Okay, so are there general principles in biology? And so what would one like about the most useful sorts of general principles? I would argue that they should be reducible to a simple idea. They should explain lots of things. And ideally, they should explain things over a wide variety of physical and temporal scales. And so I wanted to give you one example of the sort of thing that I think we should be looking for more of, and it's certainly possible there are no more of. And so this is a general principle. This is exploration with selection, a term that Mark Kirshner and John Gearhart first coined. And the idea is that you start out with something which is initially isotropic or uniform in some way, and you do exploration, and you stabilize a subset of the explorations, and you use that to successively create order. And so the example I've given here is the assembly of the mitotic spindle, the structure that segregates the chromosomes at cell division in eukaryotes. So here is a pair of sister chromosomes joined together as a result of DNA replication and various things that happen during and afterwards. And these thin lines here represent the microtubules, which grow out from microtubule organizing centers. And it's literally like people fishing for fish. The microtubules grow out, they persist for a certain time, and then they shrink back. So it's exactly like being a fly fisherman and casting for fish. And what happens is, if the microtubules contact either the arms of the chromosomes or this special black region here, which is called the kinetochore, which is a specialized protein DNA complex that is primarily designed to attach the chromosome to microtubules. Those microtubules get stabilized against the switch from the polymerizing to the depolymerizing state. Okay? And so what happens as time goes on, even though the probability that microtubules will grow out is spherically symmetrical around this microtubule organizing center, because you preferentially stabilize the ones that interact with the chromosome, you end up with this organized bipolar structure. Okay? And it doesn't require any instruction, in a sense, about where the chromosomes are. So if you like, you can either think of this as a mechanism, or you can think of this as a way of doing computation to find where objects are in space, right? And maybe that's semantic, okay? So it's creating order by sequentially stabilizing a subset of random excursions, and it's a widely used principle in biology, and it's used at many scales. It's a description of the modern view of protein folding. It's how the spindle assembles, which I just showed you. It's an example of how the nervous system develops. So in development of organisms, you send out far more neurons than you need to have, and only the ones that contact their targets get stabilized and the other ones die. It's also probably an example of how connections are formed within the nervous system. So things like, if you look in your brain, there are these columns where in your cortex input is dominated by one eye or the other, and sorting that out probably has a lot to do with this principle. It is, of course, the principle that Wallace and Darwin discovered. Right? This is the principle of evolution. And one might speculate that this applies at even higher levels than individual species in the formation of ecosystems. So what do we understand? Based on the criteria for understanding, what do we understand in biology? So I would argue that there are a couple of aspects that biologists and their colleagues, chemists in this case, have done a relatively good job of understanding. One is biological chemistry. So how biological molecules execute chemical events is, by and large, I would say, relatively well understood. And so this is just a random picture. Well, it's not quite random. This is cyclin-dependent kinase 2. This is cyclin A. This yellow molecule here is a substrate. The red molecule is ATP. This complex is going to catalyze the transfer of a phosphate group to that substrate. And how that sort of process goes on in chemical detail, and how biological systems manage to get reactions to go at room temperature and in aqueous solutions that chemists certainly can't make happen, is relatively well understood. And is one of the big triumphs of molecular biology, because it's a combination of chemistry and structural biology. And other things, starting with Mendel and progressing through this Watson and Crick and all the deciphering of the genetic code and Jacob and Monod and so on and so forth, is the transmission of genetic information, where, again, the general principles are pretty well worked out. So you may notice that this list looks very much like the list of all the things that biological systems do, and we don't understand most of them at the level of either detail or generality that we would like. And I want to give you a specific example of what I mean, and I'm going to pick rather unfairly on a system which is actually one of the few that is understood in relatively good detail. But I want to give you, first of all, the traditional biologist's view of a signal transduction pathway. So this is how you see. This is actually happening in each of your eyes. So light hits this molecule rhodopsin. Rhodopsin interacts with this protein here. It dissociates one of the subunits, the alpha subunit. This binds to an enzyme called phosphodiesterase, and it stimulates the hydrolysis of cyclic GMP. And cyclic GMP in your rod cells is a molecule that activates a channel which lets in sodium and also, to some extent, calcium. So the more cyclic GMP comes in, the more sodium goes into the cell. And despite the cell's best efforts, as Lewis mentioned, to pump the sodium out, the more sodium comes in, the less negative the inside of the cell is, and therefore the more likely it is to fire action potentials. And so paradoxically, the lighter it gets, the fewer action potentials these cells fire. Okay, and this is the basis of human vision. Now, the reason this is the typical biologist caricature is you will notice that all the arrows go in one direction. So if this was how it worked, you would all be looking at the blinding flash of the delivery room or your mother's bedroom into which you were delivered, because there are two things that this neglects to deal with: any sort of recovery once the light's turned out, and secondly, adaptation. You would have been in the womb for 9 months. It's remarkably dark in there, and you would have come out into this very bright light, and it would be like when you wake up in the middle of the night and someone turns on the lights. The room just looks blindingly bright. Okay? So to deal with that, you need recovery, and you need adaptation. And as I said, that sort of caricature description is the way most descriptions of signal transduction systems in biology is. That it's being unfair to vision, because people in vision understand both recovery and adaptation, and I thought I would just mention a little bit about this. So the total range over which you can see things is from being a baseball player swinging at a fastball to, if you are perfectly dark adapted, you could see a candle 5 miles away. Okay. I mean, there also has to be absolutely no ambient light, so you'd have to find a very dark place. So the detection range is 10 to the 10th to a single photon per second. The instantaneous dynamic range is over 100-fold, and you can locally adjust it over your retina, so that if you're looking at a room that's partly bright and partly dark, the different cells will be adapting to the local light intensity they're subject to. And this is the way adaptation works. As I mentioned, cyclic GMP stimulates this channel, and it's not particularly selective channel, so calcium, which is also on a strong electrochemical gradient to go into the cell, comes into the cell through this channel, and it inhibits the guanyl cyclase that makes cyclic GMP. So this is a negative feedback loop. So this is a homeostatic mechanism. And so one of the aspects of biology that if we're going to start worrying about how everything is put together, which in some sense is what evolution is largely about, because the eye is incorporated in a whole organism, we have to worry about how things recover and how they adapt and so on and so forth. And we'll just skip this because that was for undergraduates who can't think dynamically, and being physicists, you don't have that problem. Okay? So here's another example of trying to explain why I think biology is complicated and some of the things that biologists haven't typically worried about and maybe you could help us with. So this is a microarray experiment. When I say microarray experiment, does anyone need more amplification of what that is? So this is a method for monitoring all the different messenger RNAs in the cell quantitatively, or at least semi-quantitatively. The order vertically in this case is determined by some sort of clustering algorithm. So the way that the raw data is collected, there are individual spots of DNA on a glass slide, and the array, the order in which they're put out is effectively random, right? And so then people collect the data, and it's all in some computer file, and you cluster the genes whose behavior is most similar next to each other. Okay, so there's nothing more to it than that. So there are places where you can see how thin the individual lines are. Each one of those corresponds to a gene, okay, or to the messenger RNA transcribed from a particular gene. Across the top is the number of times in hours since a population of yeast cells was switched from growing in medium with glucose and lots of nitrogen to a medium with acetate as a carbon source and no nitrogen, which induces it to go through the meiotic cell cycle and form spores. And what you can see is a lot of genes turn off, and a lot of genes turn on. There are about 1,000 genes that change. There are 6,000 genes in total in yeast. So if you said that for each gene there were 10 parameters, so parameters mean things like the level of messenger RNA that has been transcribed from that gene, the rate of synthesis of the protein from the messenger RNA, the rate of degradation of the protein, where the protein, how the protein is distributed through the cell, which other proteins it interacts with, and again, whether that's spatially uniform through the cell, which phosphate groups or methyl groups have been added post-translationally to the protein. It's, I think, a relatively conservative estimate to say there are 10 such parameters per protein. So a given cell, in principle, could be described by 60,000 parameters. In this experiment, 1,000 genes change. So there are 10,000 parameters that are changing as cells make this trajectory.
It doesn't
matter. I mean, I'm making it complicated. Yeah, but I think, I mean, if you take, I mean, there may be some proteins where it's less than 10, right? Some glycolytic enzyme that's homogeneously distributed through the cell and supposedly is not rate limiting for glycolysis and is not being allosterically regulated. But there are certainly proteins like something like tubulin where 10 would be a gross underestimate, right? Because, you know, to describe the distribution of tubulin in the cell and what's happening dynamically probably is going to take you a lot more than 10 parameters. Okay, so, I mean, could be 5, could be 20 is the average number. I don't think that the argument will change terribly. So if 1,000 genes change, 10,000 parameters change, and so a cell is making a trajectory through 60,000 dimensional space with at least 10,000 of the parameters changing.
At that point, is it really that it's above the 60,000 dimensional space, or is it the subspace in the 60,000, which could be much? If it is a point, then your point is well made. But if it is a subspace, where, and I think that's basically what we'd like to say, right? That you don't care about the 60,000 parameters so much, hopefully. That somehow the cell is robust if you make change in maybe the 60,000
of them,
right?
Well, the question I want to raise is how do cells, I mean, maybe cells do just what you said, that they make it so that none of the parameters count except 3 of them and it doesn't matter what they are. I mean, that's an interesting, it would be an interesting question to experimentally ask, to take 10 random genes and increase their expression by a factor of 50, right? And ask how often that kills cells, right? Because that would... Well, they can survive lots of single mutations, right? So...
And they can also survive lots of different conditions. So somehow it cannot be one point. And maybe that's... Right?
Well, it doesn't... It's not saying they can only exist at one point. All I'm trying to say is that you start at one point without worrying about that for a moment whether they're subspaces or not. You start at one point and you end up at another one. The point that you end up at, a vast number of those parameters change, right?
It's not even clear. I don't agree with you with that because it seems not obvious that the parameters are well defined for one protein because the protein varies. It fluctuates, so the K interaction of these other proteins may themselves not be well-defined parameters. They may vary from protein to protein, so you may have an average of something, and it may well be that you do not have. I don't think that I agree with your point.
Well, the distribution change.
I think it is a subspace in that large dimension space, which could be itself quite large. So
I'm not saying every cell in the population is at the same point.
Right. One cell, I think it doesn't remain at one point.
No, and I'm not saying it remains at one point. All I'm saying is it starts one place and it ends up somewhere very different. And if you used a golfing analogy, it's like the tee and there's the fairway. And what golf players are supposed to do, me not being one of them, is supposed to hit the ball from one place to the other, right? And they're not supposed to hit it into the trees. Now, my naive intuition as a biologist is that as the golf course has more and more dimensions, the difficulty of that task goes up, right? And it seems to me an interesting question about biological systems. What fraction of the trajectories between those two points, whether they be individual points in some parameter space or different subspaces, what fraction of the trajectories between those two points are consistent with the cell remaining viable. I would posit that that fraction is small, okay, of all possible trajectories, right, that one could draw. And that therefore there is something interesting about how cells manage to hit the ball down the fairway. And that it's a problem that we know almost nothing about. And it's an example of the class of problems that because we have things like these systematic approaches, so we can look at all the things that are...
The same problem is talking for me, right? You have the little paradox which would make it impossible to fold. In spite of that, proteins do fold very nicely into...
Yeah, and I think it's... But the Leventhal paradox, is a little bit different. The Leventhal paradox is somewhat false in the sense that the vast majority of the conformations described by the Leventhal paradox are physically impossible because atoms end up lying on top of each other. It's much less clear for biologicals, for this sort of problem, that that's true. Now, it may be true that the organisms have evolved to make them impossible, but then that's interesting. And how they've done it is interesting.
I'm just trying to formulate this a little more precisely. So what you're saying is you've got an dynamical system of extremely high energy. Points in the stateless of that dynamical system, and there's a set which happens to contain those 2 points, which corresponds to the things that are viable for the cell, in the sense that if you get out of that set, you're complete. And what you're asking is to characterize a set of all trajectories, all solutions in the 2-point boundary value problem that do not exit this set. Is that correct? Is that exactly what you're saying?
I think that's probably what I'm saying, except you've moved beyond terminology that I'm good at dealing with.
That's going to be a very sparse set in the full.
Yeah, that's an interesting problem. Fine. That's it.
Just to go back, that's another one to from the data. You've got the green ones going ever fast, so some of them seem to go off with time. You've got the red ones, some of them also go off with time. Some of the green ones go on with time.
Thank you for asking the question. Thanks for asking the question. I didn't explain it clearly. The colors represent, all these experiments are done as comparisons. They're done as comparisons between 2 samples. So one sample never saw the medium that induced sporulation. The other one did at different time points. And they're compared, each gene's expression is compared between a given time point and the sample that never saw the sporulation condition. If there's no change, if the ratio of gene expression in those 2 conditions is 1, it's black. If it's lower than 1, it's green, and if it's higher than 1, it's red. So when it comes up, and as you point out, goes down, it means this gene was transiently repressed and then it came back on again. And for example, these guys here, they were induced for a while and then they went back to being the same level of expression as the unmolested cells. Thank you.
Intermediate trajectory. So what does it mean safe in this dynamical state? Presumably if you arrest it somewhere in the middle, the cell will die. So that state can be quite unsafe. It's just you go through it rather rapidly, and then if you go sufficiently rapidly, does it really matter?
Yeah, so Boris makes an excellent point. So there are 2 different questions. What are the states which it's safe to be in for an indefinite period? Which are the states ensembles of states which it's okay to be in as an intermediate, but you get die if you were stuck at? Right? That's a good point.
But if you like the velocity maybe to the space, then you probably still make it to a pretty kind of problem. By the way, there is a part of my analysis that is back to the question where the formula is called by the name.
Right. So maybe it's an interesting thing for us to discuss. Okay. So I'm now going to go through the fundamentals of population genetics, and I'm not a population geneticist, so I won't bristle if you criticize any of this. So population genetics, it's a statistical description of idealized creatures and genes. Its virtue, according to population geneticists, is by placing things in mathematical equations, it forces you to state your assumptions. Its vice is that the assumed world is not always equal to the real one. it deals best and was invented by R.A. Fisher, largely for this purpose, with changes in the frequency of variant forms of genes that already exist within populations. It can be adapted to incorporate new mutations, and these are classified as either being better for the organism, worse, or neutral. And so it assumes that all mutations are point mutations, and by and large for mathematical tractability, and when Fisher and his colleagues invented it, it was before the advent of computers, and so if you couldn't solve things analytically, you basically couldn't solve them. And so making the effects of the mutations be small allowed you to make approximations that allowed analytical solutions to
that's
equation.
A minor, it's not a little point mutation. All mutations make point mutations, it's a minor one. I don't see why that's an assumption.
Well, classical population genetics, if you read something like, and I have it in my bag here, there's this little primer on population genetics Dan Hartle wrote, and there's a sentence which says population genetics, you know, essentially deals with point mutations, and it's incompetent to deal with, you know, things like gene duplication, fusion, deletion.
Okay.
I mean,
it's not clear that those are, in some sense, enormous extrapolations, but maybe we have to do a lot more.
No, but if the interesting things in evolution are dominated by mutations that have very large effects outside the effects where the assumptions or the approximations made in traditional population genetics are invalid, it may be great for describing the sort of thing that Dobzhansky looked at, like chromosome polymorphisms, and it may be very good even at describing speciation between closely related species. It may be very poor for describing major evolutionary innovations, which I guess I'm more interested in.
That's the problem with diet. See, I've become a creationist as well. And let me tell you the reason. I find it very difficult to understand the adaptive advantage of small mutations. In many cases, I know that it's nice, you know, I'm a gradualist, sure. But why it should be adaptive? Well, this is not the moment to go into, but just try and think about how. I mean, what's the advantage of having wings until you can fly?
Yeah, I mean, maybe.
I don't want to get into that. But the small thing that's lovely that makes sense, but why isn't it?
This will come up, so maybe we can talk. And that's also, it seems like, a very good subject for discussion. Okay. So the formalism is that each gene there can be many different forms known as alleles, 1, 2, 3, and on up. Fi is the allele, population geneticists call it frequency, that makes physicists irate, so we can call it the allele fraction, but it will make it hard to read population genetic text, because frequency is supposed to refer to changes with respect to time. And the sum of those all comes to one. Okay? Fixation occurs when only one allele is found of a gene, okay? And it means that the allele fraction gets to be very close to one. N is the population size. Population geneticists worry a lot by something called the effective population size, which has to do with the fact that populations fluctuate over time. Okay? And what you would ideally like to do the formalism, is to think of a population of uniform size reproducing asynchronously. That is, everyone gives rise to progeny and immediately dies, okay? Because it makes the math easier. And so what the effective population size is, the size of a population of that nature that would give you the same properties as the wildly fluctuating irregular population that you have to deal with in the real world. And that's defined as the harmonic mean of the real population. So G here is the number of generations, and N1, 2, and 3 is the size of the population. After each generation, there are obviously interesting questions about how many generations you should be worrying about. And for example, people like Daniel worry about that, and we could discuss that too. The human population size, this is within a factor of 2, right? But the effective population size is only 10 to the 4th, okay? And that represents the fact that the population, that this, This is dominated by the smallest population sizes. And not very long ago, there weren't very many of us. So that even though there's 6 billion of us now, it doesn't matter tremendously much for the genetic structure of the human population. Well, in the idealized version where each generation reproduces synchronously and then obligingly dies, this is just the number. This is the number after each generation.
Well, I was just wondering what number we use to do this computation. What's that from G?
It's a number of generations.
So 10^4 is inferred from data.
10^4. Yeah, 10^4.
I'm sorry. So there is no G that is
known. It's inferred from statistics of neutral or non-linear computation.
Well, I don't think you missed it. I didn't say it.
But I think one does have to distinguish between some of the assumptions which are made because you can't do certain things mathematically, and the assumptions which are made, which are sort of some of the essential ones, like the degree of just a fitness, and which is at least reasonably independent of a lot of other things around and so on. And they're harder to get away from. While a lot of the things which you say, something made in that traditional population, and that's how Dan Oren defines it. It seems to me those ones might as well just go out from the beginning.
We could get you to talk about it, lead a discussion section, and talk about it. I'm not disagreeing with that. Okay. So fitness is the number of viable offspring produced per generation. The average fitness, W bar, is usually set to 1. S is the selective coefficient associated with a particular mutation. It can either be positive or negative, and so the fitness of some individual which has only one mutation that affects it is 1 plus SI, where that's the fitness associated with that particular mutation. Epistasis refers to the interaction between mutations, which is what Daniel was just getting at. So imagine a case where you have two mutants, both of which are less fit than the population mean. It's called synergistic epistasis if the individual which has both mutations is less fit than the product of the two individual mutations, and it's called diminishing returns epistasis if the reverse is true. And so one of the problems in terms of applying population genetics theory, even if the theory was absolutely fine and none of the things that we're worrying about were problems, is that in general the distribution of fitnesses of individual mutations and the epistatic interactions between them in populations is utterly unknown. Okay. Something is good if S is positive, and it's bad if S is negative.
Synergistic means worse rather than better. Diminishing returns better.
It means. Well, it means that this means that the effect of the double mutation is larger than you predict, right? And if the two are individually good, it means. The terms are used in a confusing way in population genetics. Yeah, it means that this is not as bad as you expect it to be, and this is worse than you expect it to be. And for advantageous mutations, I would define synergistic as being that this would be better than you expect the two to be, and this would be not as good as you expect the two to be.
And if one positive, one's positive, one negative, then how would you find it?
I'd go out for beer at that point. Well, I'm not a part. Don't hold me to. Okay. So the chance of an advantageous mutation going to fixation is 1 over S, which means the more advantageous it is, the more likely it is to get fixed in a population, and the less advantageous, the less likely it is. The number of generations to fix an advantageous mutation is the log of the effective population size, the natural logarithm, divided by S, at least as long, that's a reasonable approximation as long as S is small. And the rate at which advantageous mutations are fixed cannot be...
Well, you need a 1 over S.
It's log NE divided by S. Which thing are you challenging? Yeah, it's outside the log, sorry.
It's,
why is the first one over S?
The larger S, the more advantageous the mutation, right?
Sorry, it's S, excuse me. My mistake. Thank you. And the rate at which such mutations are fixed is not higher than this number, although it can be lower, and that gets into questions about whether sex is a good thing and so on and so forth.
What is mu?
Mu is the mutation rate.
No, it's any mu s.
Wow, because you're taking account for this. Yes. And the chance of neutral mutations fixing is 1 over NE. So in large population sizes, it's very small.
But it's more or less the definition of NE.
And it's more or less the definition of NE. The very small number that do get fixed, it takes a very long time to do so. Okay. The ones that get lost, it takes much less time to do so. And the rate at which neutral mutations are fixed is roughly independent of the size of populations. Because you generate them faster if you have big populations, but the probability of fixing them goes down, and those two factors cancel out. Okay. So that's an introduction to the formalism. Is it still as impenetrable as it ever was, Lewis? So now I want to talk about questions that all this brings up. So one of them is how important it is to select for reproduction versus survival. So classical population genetics is by and large is assuming a sort of race for reproduction. And you could imagine having two subpopulations within a species, one of which did an extremely good job of reproducing when times were good. Well, but that's what selection. I mean, the selection. I mean, how many viable offspring you give rise to, is the result of selection. If you are, you know. Right. So that's what. Okay. So one of the problems with population genetics. One of the problems with population genetics is over how many generations should fitness be defined, right? And so it's that's an issue that I've talked about with population geneticists, because they will admit, as you are pointing out and as I would agree with you about, that defining it over a single generation, you could leave a lot of population, a lot of progeny who are viable but extremely weak-willed and incapable. And so, in principle, it ought to be some integrated definition over a relevant period of time. And it's a little hard to decide what relevant is, and it all gets harder to do the math and so on and so forth. But that, I think, is another of the limitations of population genetics, is you don't really... And I guess that's partly what I'm getting at here, is that you could think of a population being subdivided into two halves, one of which will do extremely well when an asteroid hits and conditions change fast. Right, and just the ability to survive is an issue, and another which is a good drag racer and does a very good job of reproducing quickly when the conditions are optimum. And one of the things that's worth pointing out is that everything that is alive on the planet today is part of a 4 billion year long great chain of being. That is, it has an unbroken chain of ancestors going back to the origin of life, because if the chain's broken, it ain't here. And so survival has clearly been very important. And so if you imagine having one of the guys who reproduce faster being reproducing 1.1 times as fast as the guys who reproduce slower, it will take 145 generations if this mutation arises to fix in the population. And so that assumes that for 145 generations, which means 10 to the 43 progeny per founder, which is probably more than the number of atoms in the Earth, that, you know, conditions stay the same and nothing gets in the way. And so one of the questions I'm interested in is how does one try and integrate fluctuating environmental histories, and particularly the possibility that on a fairly regular basis many organisms go through times which are extremely challenging for them, with the standard formalism which deals really with reproductive success in the good times. So none of these things are their answers, at least that I can give. The second question is about the balance
between... Well, the question is not even really well posed.
I would agree completely with that, and so that a useful, if out of a week of being here and talking to each other, we could come with out of it with some slightly better posed questions, that would be a good thing. So the second question is the balance between robustness and evolvability. So what robustness means is resistant to perturbation, genetic or environmental. I'll point out in a somewhat trivial demonstration of robustness, which is that it is almost certainly true that everyone in this room contains a mutation in one copy of a gene that is essential for life that utterly destroys the function of that gene. That is, you are carrying a recessive lethal mutation. Now, fortunately, when people marry each other, they usually carry recessive lethal mutations in different genes, and so they don't produce a quarter dead progeny. Okay? But it's a demonstration of the fact that for most genes, with a very few exceptions, which are all clinically unfortunate, it doesn't matter, by and large, in a way that you can tell by looking at your neighbor, that they have one active copy of a gene or two. So that you're, and since most genes are, the proteins are expressed in fairly strict proportion to the number of copies of the genes, it means you can withstand twofold quantitative fluctuations in the abundance of most proteins.
Without any question that statement you just made, because it could potentially be some feedback mechanism that maintains the protein level constant.
There could, in most of the cases where people have looked in, it's been looked at more in yeast than in people, but in most of the cases where people have looked, there aren't feedback mechanisms. There are clearly exceptions where there are, but they are the exception.
And one actually does find it, fairly accurately twice the level that you have actually both genes.
Well, I would say, within the average biologist measurement, which is probably good to within a factor of 20%. That is, you can tell the difference between less and more, but I wouldn't.
Okay, but 20%, that's
yeah. Absolutely, absolutely, which comes back to interactions between things. Yes.
And the protein itself wasn't bad for you, but then when you have two genes of that type, you get twice the amount of protein and die.
There are exceptions. And so, I mean, the things that people focus on, so there are genes like tumor suppressor genes, where having one copy rather than two is bad, but it's not by and large bad because you have half as much protein, it's because you have half as many genes. And now it only takes one mutation to inactivate the remaining copy. Okay? Okay, so evolvability is the ability to change function, okay? And one of the things that's challenging is to define this in any way except as the opposite of robustness, in which case, if that was true, you don't need two terms. And so this is a diagram to try and explain what I would see as the difference between robustness and evolvability. So this is a caricature where there are two parameters that describes some system, and the system was designed by evolution or selected by evolution to act as some sort of switch. And robustness refers to how big the area and parameter space is where this thing functions as a switch, okay? And this is clearly more robust than this is, because that area is bigger, okay? But in these first two cases, once you go outside that region, the system is just broken. It doesn't do anything interesting or good. It's just dead, okay? In these two cases, when you cross the boundary where it stops being a switch, it does something that could conceivably be useful to a biological system. So in this case, it turns into a graded response, and in this situation, it turns into some feedback mechanism that tries to maintain a constant value. Now again, this is more robust than this because the pinkish area is bigger, but they're both evolvable in the sense that everywhere you cross this perimeter, you go into some function that could be biologically useful, whereas these guys aren't evolvable because over here it's just busted. Now obviously there's a it's my definition of what's useful here, and one could argue about what an organism's definition of what's useful, but at least I think it helps to indicate that the two terms aren't merely the inverse of each other. Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, again, things get very complicated when you start to think of things interacting with each other, which is the essence of biology. And so you're absolutely right that the ability to explore this parameter space, if the things, the parameter one and parameter two are important for other things, would allow those other things to be evolvable, right? And therefore the genetic system as a whole, but it's not allowing this individual function to be evolvable in that sense. Is that a fair enough description? But your point is an important one. The next question is, what are the units of biological function? So this is the diagram I used before. This is this very important protein kinase that controls the progress of the eukaryotic cell cycle. And what's evolution really selecting on? Is it directly selecting on, for example, the catalytic activity or the substrate binding capacity of this enzyme, so that, to annoy Daniel, you can have situations where one of the two, one mutant becomes fitter at the expense of the other, and what's really been being selected? I mean, in some important sense, worrying about time. No, that's fine. So we should make a 15 more minutes, or do you think that's? So the question is, although enzymes get optimized by selection, organisms, God isn't looking at organisms and going, well, you know, catalase is a little bit more efficient, I'll pick this one. The selection must be acting on something else. And the question, I think quite important question, is what selection is. And I'll just introduce the concept of what I would call a functional module, which I think Nama will talk more about, or talk about how you might define them or find them. And what I mean is collections of molecules that act together to achieve some specific biological function. And so this is one such example. This is an oscillator that drives the cell division cycle. You don't need to worry what any of the names there mean. This in turn is connected to another module, which is what assembles the spindle by that process I described earlier. So the changes in the activity of this protein kinase change the behavior of microtubules and chromosomes in a way that ultimately, through this sort of self-assembly logic, ends up with this structure. And it's very important for the cell to segregate its chromosomes properly that the kinetochores, which are here drawn red because they haven't attached to microtubules, manage to attach to microtubules, because if the cell tries to divide like this, it doesn't have the right instructions to tell these chromosomes where to go. And so there is a separate module that does that checking, and in turn inhibits a step in this clockwork mechanism here to keep it from going forward until the spindle's been properly assembled.
Okay.
Well, a module, for example, is the set of molecules that are responsible for making sure that the activity of CDK1 goes up and down in a rhythmically oscillating way. And if, for example, in an early frog embryo, this oscillation occurs entirely independently of this and of this. Well, I would. I would call it a module that exists to check the performance of this module and using that information to regulate the performance of this.
It's like a skeleton module.
You could say it's a collection of modules.
But my problem is if I mix something in the cell, I'm talking about eukaryotic
cells.
How would I know whether
it was
a module?
I would say you would know if it's a module if you could make the reasonable claim that its components function together to achieve a particular function which selection acts on. Okay? So let me...
Well, you can also say the complexity of the function is much less than the complexity.
Right, I mean, Lewis's question is a good one. Is this just some piece of mumbo-jumbo that there's no reality behind? And so what I would argue is, if this concept has merit, there should be ways, ideally objectively, of defining what is in modules. Ideally, there should be independent ways that define the same things as being in modules. And they should then correlate to what we as biologists subjectively think of as individual functions. And there isn't really time, especially since we're under time pressure, there isn't time to talk about it, but there is evidence, a growing body of evidence, that suggests that there are independent objective ways of defining them. They do define by and large the same things, and those do correspond to things that as biologists we think of as biological functions, which we can talk more about. I just don't.
Just a short question.
Yeah. Right, you could have things that act on short time scales and long time, but not in this case, no.
That's not
no. Right, and you could argue that these are sub-modules of a given module. I mean, deciding at that level, I think, is hard. Right, exactly. Exactly. That half an oscillator, that the machinery for synthesizing cyclin without the machinery for degrading it is not a module, or vice versa. Okay? And so I'm just going to skip through one of the demonstrations that argues that this is a reasonable way of thinking about things, which we can talk about in discussion, but I don't want to. So if this concept has merit, what might it be good for? It might be good for answering questions about integration, how all these different things are put together. It might be good from escaping from molecular tyranny in the sense that if you could describe the properties of a module without worrying desperately about the molecules within it, you might be able to work with a much smaller number of parameters. So if you look at typical sort of applied mathematicians' models of how things work in biology, the cell cycle being a good example because there are people who've worked on this hard, those models which are try to be as molecularly realistic as possible have on the order of between 50 and 100 parameters associated with them. Most of those parameters have not been measured, okay, so they're effectively free in the model. Very few of the data sets which the models are being fitted to have 50 good data points in them. right? And so there's a serious problem. And modules might be good in evolutionary terms for asking about how you can alter one function without disaster elsewhere, because the sort of corollary question to Lewis's thing about how do you make wings before you can fly is how do you do anything if everything's tightly coupled together without completely screwing something else up? And they also imply that if function is modularized in this way, you could create evolutionary novelty, not necessarily by inventing new functions, but just by connecting existing ones in different ways. The next question is, does population genetics describe evolution properly? And the question is it are there minor errors versus entirely the wrong picture? And one example of that is, are these things called adaptive landscapes, which population geneticists refer to a great deal, the idea that this guy is tremendously fit, but to get to here is almost impossible because fitness would have to go down so much. Right? Well, the argument is that the system has two states, one's good for flying and another's good for swimming, and to go in between them requires a set of intermediates which is spectacularly bad at doing either, and therefore are very unlikely to succeed it. Right, but the population geneticist's interpretation of the developmental problem is it's an insoluble one. Right? Right, and it also relates to questions about if fitness, I mean, this is drawn here as a two-dimensional model, and in sophisticated versions it's drawn as a three-dimensional model. But if fitness is in some vastly multi-dimensional space, do these things exist? And that's an open question. And this gets back to Daniel's question, which is, fitness is only terribly helpful if it doesn't fluctuate wildly with context. And if the fitness of individual mutations not only changes magnitude, but changes sign as a function of the other mutations in the genome, it's a little hard to see how all this works. In the interest of time, the next question is, how common is evolve or die? And all I mean by that is how frequently are organisms in a situation where unless the genetic structure of the population changes, they will go extinct? And I think knowing the answer to that's important, and that we don't. The next question is, can organisms control evolution in some sense? That is, can you control the mutation rate? And if Miroslav Radman, who was supposed to be here, was here, which he's not going to be, unfortunately, he would have talked about situations where heritable mutators increase in frequency in bad times because, and it's as if, and I emphasize the as if, the population knew that times were hard and that the chance of being able to survive goes up through mutation, even though most mutations are bad, and therefore it makes sense to have more mutators around. That's an anthropomorphic description, although it's surprising how often thinking very anthropomorphically is useful in evolutionary biology. The second question is, can you control how much phenotypic change you get per mutation? So that probably has both to do with sort of within module effects, if you believe in modules, where if you have two overlapping genes that perform similar functions in the same module, if both of those do very much the same thing, you may get less phenotypic change for genetic change than if they do somewhat different things. And in a global level, there are things like arguments made based on chaperone functions, and Jonathan Weissman will talk about prions, where people argued that you can change the amount of phenotypic effect you get for a given gene, for a given mutation, by varying things within the cell. And the last question is, what is the role of pre-existing versus novel variation in mutation, in evolution, sorry. And the last question, which comes back to what Lewis was talking about, is, so the argument for celestial design was advanced by an English 18th century clergyman who argued that if you found a rock on the ground, you might not find it necessary to invoke a creator, but if you stumbled over a watch, someone had to make the watch. Now, thanks to Darwin and Francois Jacob, who introduced this nice word, tinkering, tinkering makes the watchmaker, that is us who make God. Okay? If you're a creationist, the arrow obviously goes in the other direction. And the question is, in practice, how does this work? So how much genuine invention is there versus recycling? Because the more recycling there is, the easier in some sense it gets to explain evolution. And how well does gradualism explain whatever your favorite example is? So Lewis is flying. Darwin went to some length in The Origin of the Species to explain how an eye could evolve gradually and how each intermediate could have selective advantage. One thing that seems quite challenging is to think about metabolic pathways so that, you know, you can appeal to the ancestral organisms living in a sea where there was adenine in the sea, and eventually they started to synthesize adenine, and the synthesis, biosynthesis of adenine goes through 10 steps. Lots of the intermediates aren't terribly stable, and it's a good challenge, if an annoying one, to think about how evolution managed to deal with that. And the last question, which Marianne and Felix will presumably talk a good deal about, is how do developmental pathways evolve? Which actually, I have to say, to me seems easier than this question. And one of the interesting questions about this that I'm sort of interested in is, are there things about the way life was early on when, for example, organisms had genomes that were much more plastic and replicated enormously less well, so mutation frequencies were much higher, and maybe had many, many copies of each individual gene that help explain how this happened? Again, beerish topics. All right.